Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
On our latest episode, I have an interview with comedian AJ Lamar, and then my pal Garth Jones introduces his new Ozploitation segment, Pass the Ammo, as we look back at Mad Max. My name is Justin Hamilton, and we're avoiding the Knight Rider here on Big Squid. Welcome to our latest podcast. I'm very excited to introduce you to AJ Lamar. This is his first appearance on Big Squid, and I'm a big fan of his. After the Sydney lockdown finished, or as anyone in Melbourne would call it, you call that a lockdown? And I'm guessing the rest of the world calls it, wait a minute, Melbourne, hold my drink. Anyway, after the first Sydney lockdown finished, or the only Sydney lockdown finished, my first gig back was with AJ, and I hadn't met him before. Big fan right off the get-go. I thought he was fantastic. He was very funny. He was a good guy. And it was just so nice to see someone dressed up and bringing glamour back to the stage. Like, I'd just spent 10 weeks catching myself in the mirror in a tracksuit and, you know, shorts. So seeing someone look fantastic was just glorious for my four eyes. So I was keen to get him on the podcast, not only to introduce you to him, or maybe you're already a fan, so maybe this podcast will just give you a little bit more insight into AJ, but I'm keen to do some more work with him down the track, so this is an opportunity for you to get in there on the ground level, and then when he turns up on, say, our next live show, you'll be able to really enjoy where he's coming from. Also, my good friend Garth Jones begins a new segment, Pass the Ammo, where he's going to talk us through the genre of Ozploitation. We thought we'd start at a place that would be at least familiar for you. You might not have seen this movie, but we thought we'll start at a place that at the very least, you've heard about it. And so we thought we'd begin with the original Mad Max movie. We've been talking about doing this segment for a while, so I'm really glad I can finally get it up. This has actually been quite a few months in the making. And as a heads up as well, in a couple of weeks, I have an interview with the author of XX, a novel graphic, Ryan Hughes, and it's a big interview. You know from previous episodes of Big Squid that I've talked about how much I loved the book, and we had a little bit of contact online, and the other day I recorded a big interview with him. I got up at 4:30 in the morning, and was hoping to, you know, get 20 to 30 minutes, and it is much longer than that. He was so generous with his time, I couldn't believe it. So I'm giving you a heads up because it won't come out for a couple of weeks, but if you were thinking of reading XX, or maybe you've already begun, just giving you a bit of time to get further into it. There are mild spoilers in the podcast, but if you want to wait and hear the interview first before committing to the novel, you'll be fine as well. Personally, I don't think the spoilers detract from anything. I personally went into the novel knowing very little and found that to be a great way to enjoy the complete work. But if you want to wait and listen and then decide, oh yeah, this sounds like something I'd be into, you'll be fine. It's not really giving away too much. I tried to talk very obliquely around a lot of the plot points, and specifically one, I actually talked to him for a little bit before we started recording, so I didn't give anything away. But if you read the book and you get towards the end, or when you get towards the end, you know me, there's something that'll make you laugh a lot. It's not necessarily funny in the book, but just because of our relationship. So that's happening in a couple of weeks. If you have read it, or you're about to read it, or you are reading it, head over to our Big Squid Facebook page, join our private chat group so you can share your thoughts with not just me, but all of our community there who are wonderful. There's so many different chats going on, lots of different threads, and I really enjoy it there. I don't enjoy Facebook, but I really love our community, and I'd love you to be a part of it. One more quick thing. I was going to have Rove on this podcast to talk about The Falcon and the Winter Soldier. Now, as I've alluded to in the last couple of podcasts, I've been working on a TV show, and they are long hours. And on Friday night, I got out of the studio past 11 o'clock. So I was keen to watch it, raced home. I was buzzed, actually, because I liked the trailer. I liked both characters. I thought it was an interesting premise. And then I watched the first episode, and I thought it was fine. Literally that. Fine. I reckon 8 eyes. Fine. And look, I just don't think there was much meat on the bones. I didn't dislike it, but I've heard everyone involved in this series refer to it as an 8-hour movie, or 6-hour movie, however many episodes they are. 6-8-hour movie. Anyway, you get the gist. And that drives me mental, because that doesn't work for me on TV, because the form of TV is episodic. You can still tell a long-form story, but each episode has to be its own thing. And I just thought this first episode felt like the opening act of a film, and by the time we hit the most interesting part of that first episode, it finished. Like, I'm not going to give anything away in case you haven't watched it yet, but the most interesting thing happened. I was like, here we go, and it was the credits. And then I sat through the credits in case there was something at the end, and there wasn't. So yeah, I'm just going to hold off and give it a few more episodes to see if it is worth discussing before I bring Rove in. Rove's busy as well, and I'd rather just have more to talk about. Otherwise, it will just be 20 minutes of me saying, yeah, it was okay. And you know what? I don't think that feels interesting to record, and I don't think that's interesting to listen to. I don't want to do that to you. I want to have some emotional attachment to what I'm talking about, even if you're being critical. Anyway, at the very worst, if it doesn't improve, for me that is, like you might have loved it, I hope that you got more out of it than I did. But at the very worst, if it doesn't improve, after 3 or 4 eps, we'll bring Rove in, and at least we can discuss that, because there'll be more to really dig into. Anyway, as I've always said, I'm always keen to hear your thoughts. And head over to the Facebook page and please share them. We've already got a thread going there. It seems like the Big Squid community is on the same wavelength with me. That doesn't mean you're incorrect to have enjoyed it. Come in. Convince us we're wrong. Like, I'm up for that. And I would much rather love things. That would be on my tombstone. He would have much rather loved everything. Okay. I'm going to bring in Garth Jones, a friend of mine who is also the author of the soon-to-be-released Homebrew Vampire Bullets, a book that Tony Martin, yeah, that Tony Martin, described as fucking great stuff, relentlessly funny and inventive. I was pissing myself. I've read a lot of Homebrew Vampire Bullets. Well, I've read iterations of it, and that feels like a perfect quote. Garth and I have been friends for a long time. He's made posters for The Shelf. If you ever went to our shows in Melbourne, he created the app we used for my show Circular back in 2011. Back in 2011, we had an app where you could... It was just around the time where people were always on their phones when they're in the audience, so we created an app that had different stories, and if I said something, you could... If you found that interesting, you could click on things and you could find little bits of extra story, etc. And look, to be honest, it didn't work, because as soon as you say to people, you know, you can get out your phones, the whole audience looked at you as if to say, you're tricking us, aren't you? And instead, I just had a really focused audience for that whole season. You can't win sometimes. Anyway, felt like a good idea. And I love Garth. He's fascinated by the works of decadent rock and roll scholars, debauched fantasists, and occult piss takers. You can find more of his work at passtheamyl.com, and I'm pleased to welcome him to this show with his very own opener. So before we started recording, I was talking to a mate of mine, and she'd never really heard the term Ozploitation before, and I tried to explain it to her, and I discovered that, you know, when you know something, but you don't know how to succinctly sum it up. And I was wondering, are you capable of doing that for us?
No.
Great catching up, and I'll see you next time. But it's hard, isn't it?
It's difficult. I suppose it's a case of... what are you talking about? Sort of the genre of film that might have started being made in the 70s when Australia was pretty confident about making weird shit, and then sort of slowly fizzled out into the mid to late 80s. Stuff with limited budgets, think, you know, concepts that you could get away with that were far more insane. Lots of stuff that obviously no one would dare film today either. You know, obviously some of the content is not for 21st century sensibilities a lot of the time. I'm especially thinking of stuff like Fair Game. I think it was called Fair Game, something from the mid-80s, where, you know, the cover of the VHS was a woman strapped to the bonnet of a ute in her underpants, that sort of gear. But then I think, you know, there was a slight resurgence with stuff like Wolf Creek as well, and a few things like, you know, what was his name? The director of Wolf Creek... completely escapes me.
I do know his last name. You know what's unfortunate was I was talking about the work of Greg Larson earlier, so I've got Greg's name in my... McLean,
yeah. I was going to say Lee, so there we go, yeah. But yeah, I mean, crossing a whole bunch of different oeuvres, I guess, as well. You know, you've got, like, giant, you know, feral pigs in Razorback that are obviously paper mache half the time. You know, what we'll get to, obviously, in Mad Max, which is obviously the sort of revhead culture stuff. Lots of cars, obviously, lots of motorbikes, lots of crazy stunts, lots of boobs.
It's funny, isn't it? I kind of look at Ozploitation films. It reminds me a little bit of when I first started comedy in the early 90s, where it's like, you've never had a bad idea. Like, you've had heaps of bad ideas, but you don't realise some of them are bad ideas, and you just... commit to them fully.
And there was, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, George Miller, director of the Mad Max films and all the rest, he was a doctor that was funding the films through his, you know, practice during the day, because no one was going to finance the movies otherwise. But there was a little bit more of that sort of punk spirit happening then, sort of just make it.
And was that the appeal for you when you were getting into that genre? Was it the sense of that there weren't rules, that it was just stick your hands in and go for it?
Yeah, I think so. Like, I In terms of the book project, Homebrewed Vampire Bullets, it sort of spun out of working with a film distribution company for a few years, was sort of the linchpin of actually getting going, where I was exposed to a lot of those titles and seeing a bit behind the scenes as well of how the contemporary versions were made and not really living up to the same sort of aesthetics and values that the stuff that was coming out 40 years ago were. I just sort of that DIY aesthetic, the idea of just getting stuck in there and actually just making something that, yeah, there's no rules, there's no breaks on it, just fucking go for it sort of thing, really appeals to me.
It literally can be summed up as fucking go for it. It's funny, Ozploitation has found an audience overseas and it's quite relevant to someone like Quentin Tarantino. What do you think it is about that genre that appeals to people overseas who might not have, you know, the background that we have?
I guess we're pretty exotic. You know, Australia can be perceived, well, you know, the landscape, you know, the attitudes on film are pretty unique in terms of how people perceive you. You know, obviously to Americans, we're a pretty fascinating breed. And just the, you know, obviously the, even just down to sort of the technical aspects of how the films were made, you know, they're really impressive in a lot of aspects, you know, cinematography wise, stunt choreography. Obviously some of them are appalling. Like I rewatched Howling 3 a little while ago, which is set in Australia and has got some very questionable depictions of Indigenous culture, and it's a ride. And yeah, again, it's sort of down to that sort of paper mache aesthetic and just a bunch of, I think Barry Otto's in it. He was doing like a bunch of, you know, he made The Punisher a few years later, the Dolph Lundgren version, but he was turning up in whatever they'd, you know, throw him in the 80s. But yeah, I guess it's, yeah, just that sense of like it was that sort of cowboy filmmaking thing must appeal across the ocean, across, you know, across cultures as well.
Well, you know, we were going to talk about Mad Max because it felt like for people who may not be across the term and may not be across the aesthetic, it felt like this was a good place to start, especially progressing through the three sequels. But the first film, I hadn't watched it in a long time, and the opening is so visceral. And as a young boy, I found those men to be terrifying, like absolutely terrifying. And I'm curious, like, how old were you when you first saw the original Mad Max, and what was your reaction to it? And also, did you see them in order?
You know what? I don't think I actually saw them until I was about 19 or 20. I grew up in Broken Hill, and they were pretty much the background to being a kid. I think Mad Max 2, or The Road Warrior, as it was called in the States, was made when I was 4 or 5 out there. So you always just had that in the background of your consciousness, that, like, the skid marks on top of that hill, that Mundi Mundi Plains, where a lot of those scenes take place, that was Mel Gibson. All that sort of stuff was just sort of imbued into your consciousness. But I don't think, actually, I think I saw 2 first, and because I could locate all of those environments, and then went back and watched 1 probably in the same sitting, actually, and that's all Melbourne. So it's interesting in the sense that, like, it does give you a sort of the landscapes and the environment definitely sort of give you that sense of society sort of breaking down, and like the oil crisis that it's based on having its effect as the world falls apart and things get worse and worse.
That's funny, isn't it? Because that must be coming out of the crisis in the 70s.
That's right.
Because yeah. What is it? Mad Max is made in 79. So I guess it's kind of the echoes of the issues in the mid to late 70s that are influencing that film.
I think George Miller said that oil crisis was happening, and he was sort of trying to sort of transpose what was happening 10 years into the future. And looking at, like, what would the... Because, you know, you can see aspects of the culture are still there. Things are sort of teetering on the brink of being... of collapsing. But, you know, there's still sort of remnants of culture and civilization.
And it does feel like it's on the edges of society as well. Like, it's funny, you never see the cities. You just hear stories about them. And it feels like every little aspect of, say, initially the first Mad Max, like, that could be happening in... fourth suburb.
Yeah, and just, yeah, somewhere on the outskirts of Melbourne, sort of just like out, you know, maybe out near Doncaster or something, a little bit further out, or Cranbourne or something. But yeah, I mean, by the same token, the second one is there are probably three locations if you know Broken Hill. So, you know, they sort of lean on the same spots. And I'm heading out there next week, and apparently they're rebuilding the refinery set.
Yes.
That the Valkyries have fortified from her humongous. And there's apparently, yeah, they're putting it back where it was. So that'll be an interesting one to check out.
You have to take photos for us. It's funny, I found all this Mad Max Road Warrior stuff, and I was like, I'll save that for our next podcast. But yeah, rewatching this, it's fascinating because I hadn't watched it for a while, and it's interesting the way they set up Max, because you don't really even see him. It's quite a while into the movie, but he seems to represent a very Aussie male suburban ideal of, it's just a guy working on his car and he has to go to work. And then by the time you finally see him, and it's kind of a bit of a hero shot in this, you know, lower budget kind of movie. But it's funny, as soon as you see Mel Gibson, you look at him, and even though he becomes a much better actor over time, that exact moment that you see Max, you look at him and you go, that's a movie star.
Absolutely. And he was like 22, I think.
Yeah.
At the time. And yeah, just thinking of, you know, all of those, all of that setup, sort of like aspects of like a slasher film, you know, stuff that would go on to be, you know, sort of echoed in stuff like Terminator, you know, just all that sort of like, all those iconic shots and sort of setting him up as sort of like this apex predator as well when it comes to like, you know, King of the Revhead sort of thing, like the master of the vehicle. And like, it's also, you know, interesting, like, you know, the cops are all sort of like Top Guns, like there's elements of, you know, fighter pilots and cowboys there, like the Ray-Bans and all the rest, and they're sort of virtuous as compared to, you know, because we usually hate cops now, but you know, they're actually sort of larrikin bastards but still quite virtuous.
That's really interesting. It's a very different way of looking at the archetypes that has changed over the last few decades, especially like Bisley as Goose. Goose is almost the quintessential dude that you grew up with.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
There's a moment in the film that I found really interesting, which is his wife turns around to him after there's been, you know, someone who's had an accident on the road. It's the opening of the movie. And she says, "You've made the TV again." And you think, how many times has Max nailed a bad guy to such an extent they're leading the news with it?
Well, he sort of does become a bit like RoboCop too. Like, you know, gets, you know, starts to get sort of like the weird, you know, gets sort of the various additions, like the lo-fi Victorian, you know, the leg brace and all the rest, starts to get augmented a bit as he goes on. But also always sort of like, once he decides he's doing something, he's just going to like implacably go at the target. Yeah, so there's a bit of cyborg stuff there in a sort of very lo-fi way.
You know, you said Top Gun as well, and I'd never really thought about that before, but in Top Gun, Maverick's best friend is Goose as
That's
well.
That's right,
Goose,
yeah, yeah.
Goose has a bad ending there too.
You know, they're all doffing the Ray-Bans and all sort of hot-shotting around and doing the low vibration homoeroticism all the time. Or not so low, right? Not so low sometimes.
Yeah, well, there's the great Tarantino piece from that movie where he compares Top Gun to being a movie about, it's actually a homoerotic movie, and they're trying to win Maverick over. And you could look at Mad Max as the bikers are all saying, "Max, we know you're married, but you should join us," because it's so camp. Do you think that, you know, speaking of the influence as well, you know, when you see the scene for the Hall of Justice and it's falling apart, I feel like you can even see that in the aesthetic of Zack Snyder's Justice League.
Yep. And probably Zack Snyder doesn't quite comprehend how camp he is either. Deeply, unintentionally homoerotic, everything he does is. But yeah, I mean, all that stuff, that was filmed at Melbourne Jail, I think, around there. Like, that was, yeah, right in the city, I think it was. And the stuff in the garage was shot underneath one of the universities in town. It might have been RMIT, but yeah, it was in one of the car parks there. Yeah, just great use, especially like 70s Melbourne when it was obviously a borderline complete shithole. I've just been reading Dave Graney's last book, and he talks about the scene before we would have been there. It sounds like, yeah, I mean, obviously pre-Jeff Kennett, when Melbourne went to sleep at 5 o'clock and all that, or pre-Steve Brack, sorry, but like, you know, before Jeff Kennett, you know, really drove it into the toilet.
One of the criticisms I have of this movie is that there's not enough of his wife jamming on the saxophone.
Same, yep. And, you know, like, I actually went and checked, and there's, like, a sax player in Thunderdome. I don't think the second one had one. And Fury Road's obviously got, like, the Doof Warrior, so, like, they've upgraded. But, yeah, like, the saxophone actually had a through line in at least two of them. And just such a bizarre... And maybe that was Lost Boys, influence of Lost Boys as well.
I think you could be right about that as well. I think there's just a sense of humour infused in this as well. Like, it's the corporate guy who's going off to go fencing, which is just bizarre, but it's funny. The club that Goose is at is called the Licorice Pride.
Chief's the gardener, the gardening chief in his...
Well, you know, I was watching it and, you know, I was trying to think of what the influences on it were. And I don't know if this is correct, but I kind of felt like this has a bit more of a Stanley Kubrick, A Clockwork Orange influence, where, you know, you can watch that film and there's bits that are horrific and confronting, but also flamboyant and a little bit funny. And I felt like Mad Max had that too.
Definitely Toe Cutter's Gang. Definitely Droogs.
Well, I didn't realise how camp it was as a kid. Did you when you first watched it? Or were you old enough that you kind of got it? I may have been too young.
I think by then, because it would like, it had so sort of suffused itself into the culture, like it was influenced by punk, but then it went on to influence like glam metal and like, you know, your Motley Crue's, your Zodiac Mind Warps. All the comics that were obviously influenced by the costume design and everything. Probably didn't pick it up as much at the time, but definitely probably in the last, probably when I rewatched it 7 or 8 years ago when I interviewed Adrian from the Mad Max 2 Museum in Silverton. It was very, very clear the overt sort of campness of the whole thing. And then travelling through the four movies as well, like, it never really subsides. I mean, the War Boys in Fury Road, like, quite spectacular, really.
It's great. I've got some good thoughts on the second and third film, but I want to... It's really hard not to bring them up now, but I want to save them for the next few films. Just a few more things for you.
Sure.
I timed this. I don't know if you realize Goose is in 3 accidents in 40 minutes.
Steve Bisley.
Bisley. The last time we see Goose is, you know, you see kind of his hand all burnt and charred. And what's a little bit fascinating about the Mad Max films is that it's not necessarily a through line. It feels like a reimagining each time of each last film is a better version or a more ambitious version. And would you like to see Goose come back in some way in the next Max film, or do you prefer that a through line is tenuous?
I mean, what have we had? We've had Hugh Keyes Burns come back twice. Oh, he's come back for Fury Road as Immortan Joe. He was Toe Cutter. Bruce Spence came back from as a different character doing the same stuff.
Like, so weird.
There's sort of feral kids in the third one, aren't there? But we don't get a feral kid, yeah.
We really like the feral kid in the second. Let's have heaps of them.
Yeah, let's have tons of them, make them really fucking annoying, and have Angry Anderson be Wile E. Coyote for the duration.
Completely indestructible.
But yeah, I mean, how old's Steve Bisley now? He'd be the same age as Mel Gibson.
Yeah, you could bring Bisley back, right?
He could be maybe in Furiosa.
Or do you bring Mel back as someone completely different?
Has he been, has his reputation been revived?
Look, like, not for me, but he seems to still be popping up in films.
I think he's got Passion of the Christ too, but he's...
yeah, well, thank goodness. Like, I had so many questions at the end of the first one. I need that shit resolved.
Oh, yeah, what's going to happen to Jesus? Yeah. And that's another, I guess another aspect of, In the sense that, like, each film takes aspects of the previous one and reimagines it and sort of builds the myth and sort of, you know, that sort of questionable narrative sort of stuff. There's also the various sort of, like, Christ analogies or, like, you know, the idea, you know, Mel being a reluctant saviour, Max being a reluctant saviour sometimes or primarily, but then the bad guys also... could also be, you know, placed in that sort of zone as well, in the way they relate to their various cults and all the rest. There's sort of all the narratives have like sort of converging with like both sides have got understandable sort of, you know, rationales. And then Max sort of just stumbles into it and picks a side.
Could you imagine any Australian actor now being able to pull off this kind of role?
To play Mad Max.
Yeah, or are they all too knowing?
I think Tom Hardy was great. Right?
Yeah, so do I.
Yeah, I don't think that... Yeah, I mean, he's not going to be back, obviously, at this stage, but yeah, I couldn't think of a...
I wonder if Travis Fimmel could do it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because there's a very specific type of... It's really hard to describe, but there's a very specific kind of suburban Australian man who is into his cars and incredibly masculine, but also has this weird softness to them. And it can lean into a level of campness. And I think Fimmel brought that to the character of Ragnar in Vikings. And I don't know if he's been in the right role since to focus that kind of energy. And I wonder if Max could be that role for him.
Unfortunately, the only other Australian actor of that sort of generation I can think of at the moment is Jai Courtenay. So,
right.
No, not Jai. No.
To finish off... Actually, two things. One is, part of what I loved about rewatching this film, once again, I hadn't watched it in like 15, 16 years, the randomness of things that happen in it, including Benno. And Benno, who is this slightly mentally challenged character who just kind of turns up in the end. And as I was watching, I was thinking, if this was a Stephen King novel, he'd end up being the hero. Do you like the randomness of the story? Is that kind of what adds to the exploitation aestheticness of how everything kind of plays out? Like, there's a through line, but things just pop up that never really linger for too long.
I like the sort of perfunctory nature of, you know, I mean, the first one just ends. You know, you wait. Yeah, people just die. You know, I saw a quote from Mel Gibson the other day talking about the second one, but it sort of applies to the first two and then the fourth one. Mel said, "Still holds up because it's so basic. It's about energy. It didn't spare anyone. People flying under wheels. A girl gets it. A dog gets it. Everybody gets it. It was the first Mad Max, but done better. The third one didn't work at all." But yeah, it's just, yeah, completely, you know, the arbitrary nature of the whims of fate and people just being written off, disappearing, you know, the film ends at sort of just cut your hand off, see you later.
That is one of the all-time great endings.
And it just, you know, the credits roll and you're sort of like, well, what happened? You know, that I just got punched in the face for like an hour and a half. And the second one's like, I got kicked in the face for an hour and a half.
And got some interesting things to talk to you about with the... in regards to the third one, but someone who's on this podcast a lot loves the third one because it was, as a kid, their entry point into Mad Max. And it's like, oh, okay, that's kind of fascinating.
That's like seeing the prequels first, yeah?
Yeah, I think it is.
Yeah.
I think it's exactly like that.
On rewatching it, I mean, if we're going to jump, I mean, I didn't hate it. I just thought it sort of missed the point of what Mad Max is about, because it sort of got lost in the sort of building the politics and the sort of ideas around Bartertown and, you know, not enough cars.
Not enough cars.
Doing car things, yeah. And I'm not like a car guy, but like I like seeing cars go fast and go over each other and, you know, blow up.
That was actually my main criticism of the third film was like, where's the chase? Like, I know there's a train here, but I didn't sign up for a train. I want big trucks and cars. That's what I want.
Yeah, not 90 seconds or a 5 minute sequence at the end. I want the whole bloody thing. Not, you know, not methane farming. interesting world building stuff, but yeah, not enough to sort of hang in the end. And that was after the producer of the first two had passed away too, so they've sort of gotten a bit lost on that, I guess. So
yeah, I think so. But you know, the third one ends up being important for the fourth one in a way because they kind of build on stuff from the third one. But I'm really looking forward to delving into this stuff. You know, as I said, we're going to start with the Mad Max films to begin with because people might not be across this genre. So we'll kind of ease them into the world with something that even if they're not into these movies, they'll be across it as an idea. And then we'll go into some interesting places. Like there's some stuff that you've suggested that I'm like, I have no idea what that is. And I'm really excited to find out about that. Where can people find your work if they're going to look for it online?
Sure. You can go to pasttheaml.com. That's AMYL. And all the social, Twitter, Instagram, Medium and Tumblr are all pasttheaml at those respective sites as well.
Great. All right. Thanks for this. And I look forward to getting stuck into the Road Warrior. Thanks, Garth.
Cool. Thanks, Justin.
AJ Lamar is one of the rising stars in the Sydney comedy scene. He's clever, funny and erudite, but most importantly, a great guy who's fun company. I'm keen to do more work with AJ in the future. As I said, hopefully we will be able to line him up for the next live Big Squid. And if this is your first time hanging out with AJ, I think you'll quickly see why I'm keen to do more work with him. Okay, let's bring in AJ. I was using you as an example last night. I was talking to a young comedian that I was performing with at the Comedy Store.
Oh, yeah.
I won't mention who it is. It's not that it's anything detrimental, but on the Friday night, I thought he was dressed a bit casually for the store. And then on the Saturday night, he was dressed really well, and I think he looked really good. He suddenly, you know, that red curtain, he just it highlighted his shoulders. He looked awesome. And I felt like his material popped a little bit more. And I used you as an example. Like the first time we ever performed together, as soon as I saw you, it was like, right, I've got an idea of this guy. And you looked really presented and you were ready to go. And I'm curious to know, is that something that was a conscious decision? Or did you just dress like that and well, fuck, this has worked out pretty well?
Well, it's interesting. It's a little bit of both, actually. So I used to, when I first started performing in general, I used to do drag.
Right.
So I used to be a drag queen, and I was a terrible drag queen. And
why were you a terrible drag queen?
Oh, I hated lip syncing. I hated dancing.
Right.
Then I hated wigs, and then I hated nails, and then I hated makeup.
So all of it.
All of it. But I didn't know at the time that I just like wearing suits from Zara. That was it. That was the longest journey ever to get to that stage. So I just had this arsenal of like clothes and costumes I always wanted to wear.
Right.
And then I was like, well, if I'm going into stand-up, then I'll just wear it. I've paid for it. I've got an ABN. I'll claim it on tax.
Yes.
Like, that's what I'm doing. And then I was chatting to Beck Melrose.
Yes.
And she was telling me an anecdotal story of another performer who was doing this material that was kind of self-deprecating, but she was dressing really, really nicely. And she was saying that she had learned that as soon as she changed her outfit and looked a bit more like drab and a bit more casual, her material popped because the audience were seeing like a connect between how she was looking and the material she was saying.
Yeah.
And so like kind of both of those strings of journeys kind of lined up, and I was like, oh, like I'm quite camp and I'm kind of quite queer, and the material I do is a little bit, you know, a little bit friendly, awkward, campy, shy. And I was like, if I can explain that in 1 second of someone looking at me, I've saved myself like a minute of setting myself up and like, oh, I'm gay and this is me and oh, what am I like? So that's the roundabout journey of how I got there.
Yeah, no, but that's, I think it's a really underrated aspect of stand-up comedy. And it doesn't mean everyone needs to be dressed up. Like, your uniform can be casual if that's what your material is, but it's interesting, there can be that disconnect, can't there, with my favorite is the really handsome buff heterosexual 20 something male comedian on stage doing a little bit of I'm just really not sure about women, and you're going, come on mate, look at you.
Exactly. We actually had I run a show in Sydney, and we got some funding to do like a newcomers workshop and program. So instead of just doing the newcomers night, we teamed up with GD, and I got some like local legends in to kind of like help people. So we had a workshop where they practice some material, and we talked about different elements of what it is to kind of perform stand up.
Yep. From
what are the terms to how do you apply to be in a room, and what's etiquette like, do I have to stay for every gig that I ever go to for the entire show, can I leave, you know, all of that kind of stuff that everyone wishes they got in the first year. And one of the guys, absolute legend, Chris, if you look at him, you'd be like, he's a blokey bloke, he's got a big beard, he's kind of like kind of burly guy, and he's gay and he's a bear, but he happened to be wearing this top that said bloke. And it was just like bloke, and I think it was a brand of beer. But it just said bloke, and he gets up on stage and he starts setting himself up as like this really like heterosexual guy, blah blah. And then he kind of lands a punchline that was like, "Oh, I'm actually gay." Like I think one of his lines is like, "I look like the kind of guy who has a divorce settlement and pays alimony." Like that's the setup line. And then so when he comes in with like gay, like everyone cracked up, and he was like, "Oh, I wasn't like, I'm not sure what to wear," and I was like, "Wear that exact top. Wear the top that says bloke on it, because yes. You are just setting that punchline even more." And it, every time he does it, it's hilarious because you can see the audience go, "Oh,
yeah, yeah, that's so good, isn't it?" You know, that reminds me of Cameron Duggan's joke. Have you seen Cameron recently? Where he actually might be an older piece, but it still makes me laugh when he says to an audience, "I look like a guy who's had many fathers,"
and
then
then he
points out, "Still together." Like, how'd that happen? You know, and it's just a really funny twist as well.
Yep.
But also, what I like about that is, you know, watching, performing with some comedians last night and looking at some of the younger comics, some of this material is funny, but there is an interesting thing where I reckon if you ask them, why do you say that joke? Mm. They couldn't really tell you why. And sometimes you see that in routines, you can see there's like four different ideas and it has a bait and switch that effectively works in the moment.
Yeah.
But when you don't really think about it afterwards, because it's kind of like fast food, because it's just a quick snap of a joke, but it didn't really land because you don't really understand why they're saying it. And this guy going up and doing all of this stuff with bloke and then giving the reveal is like, oh, you have been... Like, an audience really enjoys being manipulated in a fun way.
Yeah, and it's I find this, like, the congruency as well, like you were mentioning, through the entire set. Like, I have, like, I kind of like dark humor. I think that's the thing when you do stand up a lot and you see it, you tend to like the really odd stuff. The odd stuff sticks out, or I find, at least for my taste, like, something's really weird, and I'm like, oh, like, this has caught me off guard because I didn't expect it. And occasionally I've written some, like, not tremendously dark, but for me, dark jokes. And I performed them and they flatline, and it's a similar element to that because I set myself up with certain types of jokes and an aesthetic that's like quite like, hey,
right.
And all of a sudden it's like, boom. And I haven't managed to like figure out the line of how to use that energy that I've created to emphasize that. And I'm in the shock stage. And I'm like, oh, like it's interesting to play with. I haven't yet figured it out how to like maneuver that atmosphere in the room, but I'm like aware of it. And it's interesting to pick up on what I've been putting out. And then, like, maybe I need to do a completely different set if I'm to use that joke or put it in a different place in that set.
That's, yeah. And this is the really fun part of comedy or doing stand-up is you know that the idea is correct and you know that there is something there that you can play with, but finding your way into it, it could be that it lives in a completely different set. It could be something as simple as a sentence of, hey, I know I've been looking fantastic tonight, but I have some dark thoughts.
Yep.
And then, you know, you give them something.
Yep.
You give them two things that are actually not that dark, and then you hit them with the third. It's like, oh, well, there you go.
Yeah.
You know, but you can sign, segue them into it kind of thing. But it's, you'll know, you just, it's the...
One day it just happens and you're like, you improvise it or... and you're like, oh, I sat there in a cafe for 2 hours trying to figure out the right sentence and I just came up with this on the fly and I found it. Great.
You have to put in the hard yards in the cafe to get to, it's, you know, you do hour long shows and everyone goes, oh, I love that bit. And you're like, oh, why didn't I just do that immediately? That was the throwaway line that I'll now keep, but but that is doing the hard yards. Just going back, I'm really interested in the drag aspect, and so we know where it ends.
Yeah.
Like, we're going full Christopher Nolan memento here, but I'm curious to know. So, what made you decide that you wanted to try drag?
That is a very good question. I feel like there was a part of me who. I only came out when I was 21, which is relatively late for I think Gen Y is that middling like generation where some people came out at like 9 and they knew the terms and you know their family loved them and the school was great and everything, and then like some parts of Gen Y like myself were still like, you couldn't have a gay teacher who was out, everyone, you know, like, and so we're that age where like it's, it, you know, hit and miss between who you ask, but I was definitely of the stage where it was like still quite taboo. Like, the only term, like, drag that I'd heard of when I was younger was associated on the same par as, like, drug dealers. It was, like, those that go to clubs and, like, they're drug dealing and they're sordid and all of this stuff. And that's the only reference I had for most of, like, what it meant to be gay. Even though I grew up on, like, How I Met Your Mother... Not How I Met Your Mother... Oh, gosh, what's that show? I've forgotten the show. I remember the scene where he's roller skating through the entire city.
Oh, The Village People?
No, it's a British... I grew up on a lot of British farces, like... Now I've forgotten them all. Carry On. I love the Carry On series.
Right.
Well, they're all gay, but, like, they don't mention it. No. Most of them are gay.
Yeah.
But, like, so I was absorbing it, but I didn't know... That's what gay could be, yes. And that was, like, there were other people, because it was usually mostly hidden in those kind of keeping up appearances type things, where it's all quite camp, and all like, quite, like...
So camp,
but, like, they're all straight, so it's just, like, this disconnect with the
You know,
term.
Usually with one female character that they say hideously sexual things towards, and you say, we can't be gay, like, he's talking about her tits.
Yeah, exactly. So I grew up all of that. So I had this weird kind of understanding of drag. So I ended up doing a lot later, probably when I was about 26. I came out when I was 21 and I was still like, well, I'm gay, but I'm not gay. I'm not going to do the gay stuff. Like, I'm just going to be, you know, the kind of gay person who just doesn't talk about it. And then I realized that that was also inbuilt in, like, this internal homophobia, because it's like, oh, if I can say I'm gay.
Yeah.
But then...
Sorry, where was this? Where were you living at this point?
I actually came out when I was living in the States. I just sent a text to my family being like, I'm gay, deal with it. And then they were lovely. And then I came back to Australia about 2 years later after I finished my degree.
And was it one of those things where... I've spoken about this recently. I had a friend that I've known for like... a long time who wanted to talk to me seriously about something, and I sat down with him and he came out to me and I had a panic attack because I had always thought he was gay. And so when he came out to me, I knew it was momentous for him, so I didn't want to take the moment away, but I was a bit like, okay.
And
so was it one of those things when you know, when you realized that you were gay, when you came out, were people surprised? Were people just a bit, cool?
It was interesting because I moved to Australia after that. So I did a year abroad in the States when I came out. I went back to the UK to finish my final year at University of Kent. And then I came to live in Australia properly, as in, like, you know, get a job and start a life and everything. So no one knew who I was in Australia. So I just was able to be out from the beginning.
Right.
But in the UK, I technically never came out to anybody. They just would have seen stuff online that one day I have a boyfriend.
Right.
So it's interesting you say that, because I technically never came out to anyone in the UK.
Right. Yeah, the UK is looking at Facebook going, what happened? He has such a better haircut. Like, what?
His girlfriend's a bit butch. but it's so interesting. Like, I haven't... well, now I can't go back to the UK anyway because of COVID. But I hadn't been back in years to the UK either, so my family know back there, my extended family, because my parents live here, but they don't. I've never had the conversation, I've never met them whilst being out. So it's this very interesting thing where I'm quite out and pronounced in terms of, like, my Facebook and my following. Like, it's not hidden, but in England it's like nobody, I've never had the conversation, right. I've never been gay on the country that is the UK technically.
Interesting. I'm sure you'll go back and it'll be fine. There'll be, you know, I'm guessing with good friends, there will just be, there'll be the people who just get it.
Yeah.
And there'll be either nothing said or there'll be a funny little comment that acknowledges it.
Yeah.
And then there will be the really lovely friend who makes too much of an effort in a way. I guess you find that guy handsome, you know. Sure.
Oh, gosh. It reminds me when when I first came out to my mum was... She was totally fine with it, but she was more protective and worried because the world is not nice, and she wanted to protect me. I remember I got a text one day. She was like, AJ, you've got to be careful. Like, there was two people attacked on the street for being gay, and I was like, oh my god, mum, where? And she was like, Uganda, and I was like, and bless her soul. I was like, I find it so beautiful. I find it so beautiful that you care for gays across the world now.
Yeah.
But also, you didn't have to tell me that.
No, it's okay. Like, it's terrible, but where I am, it's okay.
Yeah.
I can't have you worrying me every second about everything going on in the world.
She phased out, but she's like changing now. But it's very cute. Adorable.
Yeah, yeah. So you came out 21. So were you a performer? Because I'm curious about the drag side of things. So were you already performing in some way? Were you acting or?
I started Improv Theatre Sydney in an attempt not to perform. I had done some stuff in drama and I was like, oh, it's fun. And I want to make some friends in Sydney. So I'm going to try it for an improv school and then I'll meet people in the class and then maybe they'll want to go hang out and then I'll meet friends from there. So I never had this performer mindset. I was actually just trying to look and set up a bit of a life in Sydney. So I joined the first class and pretty much everyone in the class got on like a house on fire. It's where my good friend Beck, we met in that class before both of us had started stand up.
I love Beck. She's adorable.
She is a wonderful, beautiful human. And I met many other people in the scene. Jack Gow, who was in that class. I'm trying to think who else has done.
Was this a bear pack?
This was taught by Steen. It was taught by Steen actually. Yeah. He taught our first class. So I started this class and all of a sudden we're going out to comedy shows. I'm meeting all these people and I didn't know a lot of them who they were at the time because I was pretty much fresh, like 3 months in Sydney. So I'm meeting all these people and I didn't realize like the talents they had, the shows they were doing, how they integrated into the comedy scene at large in Australia and across the globe. And so I was quite privileged in that aspect because I was just like getting like meeting some amazing talented people and just being like, oh hi, that's great, oh my god, we'll go to your show. And then from there I started doing a lot more improv because I really liked it and I was meeting a lot of people and it was kind of building up a lot of great momentum. And then one day people were doing stand-up and I was like, I'm never going to get on a stage by myself. Like, no thank you, I'll stick with a team, that's great, but I can't tell jokes by myself, that's bizarre. And then one day I was asked to kind of be a part of this queer lineup and they'd kind of had some costumey thing and being brought up in this generation that also had a lot of RuPaul's Drag Race in it, I was like, oh, I'm going to do drag, I've seen it, I can, yes, mama, house down boots, like all of that stuff that just absorbs into you that I don't even know what it means. But that's, I was like, I all of a sudden the doors opened to me being out here and all of the modern gay culture rushed in. None of the legacy or the 78ers or the history, just all the contemporary drag race stuff really. So I was like, I'm going to do it, it's drag. And so I kind of started doing it then. And I was like, oh, this is fun. Like, I can take selfies and a lot of people like them. And, like, all that kind of, like, very millennial part of me started kicking off. And all the dopamine started flooding in. And I was like, this is great. I ended up doing a show for Mardi Gras called Dungeons and Drag Queens. So we played D&D, dressed in drag. We did a couple of lip syncs in between. I was terrible. And then I ended up continuing that show. I was like, I really like the show. It's fun. We had a massive turnout. There's this kind of hidden niche of LGBT plus communities and gamers that like is rarely talked about, but there are so many people who fit that Venn diagram. And so when we did the show, like we sold out four nights in a heartbeat at the at PACT.
Yep.
So then we continue doing this show and all of a sudden I've got a monthly show at the Imperial Hotel.
Yep.
You know, the home of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, like where they start their journey from, like this very important like element of drag history in Australia.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden this queen who doesn't like hair and nails and lip syncs is like having a monthly show in the basement. So I kind of just kept on rolling with this tumbling drag performance thing. And until one day someone asked me to MC a little emerging festival they were doing to support new acts. And I was like, well, MCing is not like stand-up. Like, it's not... I don't have to tell jokes. I'll just say, like, hey, coming up next is blah, blah, blah. Again, not knowing anything about what an MC does.
Right, right.
And now I'm like, oh, that actually was a bigger step than doing stand-up. That requires a lot more.
Yeah.
But in my head, I was like, I'll just introduce them. I'll get a card. I'll be like, JoJo's playing the piano. Give it up.
Yeah.
And then... And then all of a sudden I was in drag on stage by myself and I was quite comfortable in saying stuff and people were laughing at the stuff I was saying.
Yeah.
And I had that one unique moment after that very, 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 very long journey of being like, oh, I'm on stage and people are laughing at things I'm saying, and it's okay.
Yeah.
They don't hate me. They don't think I'm boring. In fact, like, people wanted to take photos of me after, and were like, I met someone like at a party many months ago now, when parties were a thing. He was like, I remember you. You did this show, and I took this photo, and then went through his phone and was like, look at us. And I looked terrible, and I asked him to delete it. but it like clearly had stuck out to a lot of people, and so I was like, ah, oh, this is okay,
right,
I could do this.
Yeah.
And then from there I started asking around for performance spots, and my friend again, Beck, had that point one raw comedy, so yeah. She was a year into it at that point, and so she was like, oh, like, I can tell you who runs like great rooms that you'd be a part of. I was doing like the Cafe Lounge as like my second gig.
Oh yeah.
which I didn't know was like a very big deal. And I was like, oh, and like luckily like it had worked out. I didn't crash and burn and everything like that. But the more I was doing 5 minute sets, the more I realized doing drag for a 5 minute set was not gonna happen.
That's too much.
3 hours in front of that for 5 minutes was not gonna happen. So I eventually started toning down a lot more what I was doing, and then now I kind of end up in this very kind of like queer-esque, like, you know, your joyous lesbian auntie in the city type aesthetic.
Right. It sounds like the equivalent of the musical comedy act who suddenly realizes, if I get rid of the guitar, I don't have to worry about a DI, and I don't have to worry about a chord, and I don't have to worry about a sound check. Actually, this is heaps easier.
Yep.
And that's
100%.
When you were dressed up in drag, did you have a different kind of persona to how you do stand-up, or has it, it feels like it would be more of a character in inverted commas.
Yeah, well, actually, it was one of the things where I realized I didn't like drag inherently, was because I had a name called Cleo, because I'm a massive Egyptology fan, and I was performing and people would call me Cleo, and I'm like, I'll just call me AJ, like... it's my name. Just me under here. It's, I'm going to act the same. But people expected me to be a lot more like sassy.
Right.
And a lot more meaner and a lot more catty. And I mean, my, you know, all of the tropes that come with being a drag queen. And that was very incongruent with who I am as a person.
Yeah.
And I couldn't, some people are able to embody a character. I'm very much just, just me. And I have a tired me, energetic me, but I can't do character like that inherently to be like, now I've got a wig on, I'm for the night, I am this person. So it was kind of a big indicator for me at that point that, okay, maybe I don't need all of this stuff.
Yeah, that's a really good trajectory though, because that sometimes, that can take people like a decade to kind of work out, and to be able to go and like do this and, oh, you know what, I don't really feel like it represents all of me, and I feel like in a way it's probably confining you and stopping your growth, because you're having to live up to this ideal of what a drag queen is. So what a great set of beats to get to where you are now. Also, it sounds like your naivety of the rooms and the people was great, because it meant that you weren't building shit up too much before you went and did it.
Yeah.
So you just go in, you go, I want to do well. I've got the nerves that you should have, but I'm not thinking, if I don't get this right, I'm never coming back to the Comedy Lounge, you know? Yeah. And so there's a freedom to that, isn't there?
Yeah. And it's, I also feel like it speaks to, this kind of contemporary idea that change is not allowed. We I think as a society, we're like, we all should be able to change, but people are very kind of inherently stuck on these ideas that you can't actually change that dramatically. You can only do things a little bit at the time. Like for me to be like, oh, I'm actually going to stop drag now, I'm going to do stand-up, like a lot of people are like, oh,
right,
we don't like that anymore.
Right.
But I'm like, I'm still me. Like, I was doing the same jokes, but some people are like, well, you're not doing drag, I'm not like a part of, I don't want to do that anymore, I don't want to come watch you. And I'm like, I was doing the same thing. So it was interesting from that perspective as well. But yeah, I'm kind of blessed. I've been, like, luckily naive from my career thus far. And it's helped a lot, you know, not going to rooms with very big names with like impressive careers that I just was not privy to at the time, and not being like, oh my god, how am I going to perform after them? Everyone's going to hate me, and then I might as well just sit down and just not do anything. You know, let those voices predominate my thoughts, but instead just being like, oh, you did great.
Yeah.
And then they're like, who's that kid just giving me props? Like, just walking around and be like, oh, well done. Like, as I go up, like, merrily on my way in my pantsuit.
For the most part, I think that's a really good thing. But then, like, I've had that in the past. This is going back nearly two decades, where I was meant to headline a gig in Melbourne during the comedy festival. And Al Murray popped in and said, can I jump up and do five before the headliner? And he did like half an hour, and then he just killed, and it was the end of the night, and I said to the guys who were running it, let's not have me go up because this has been great. And they said, oh yeah, no, fair call, why don't you headline next week? Okay, no worries. And then the following week there was a comedian who came along who said they wanted to get up and do five, and I'd only vaguely heard of this person at this point, and I was, oh, I've heard some good things, so yeah. And this guy did 45 minutes, and this was back when, like, I'd already put this gig off, and it was paying me essentially the money that I would buy groceries for the last 2 weeks of the festival. Yeah. So I had to get up, and I died. And I've never worked harder to have such an average response. But the person that I got up after was Daniel Kitson. And this is how much Daniel Kitson killed. He opened and he said, I bought some trousers today. And the audience lost it. And then even he didn't. He was like, why are you laughing at that? And I'm like, why is everyone laughing that much at that? This is a disaster. And then I went up afterwards and it was... anyway, good memories, you know, keeps you humble, you know. Nothing just, better than having that moment where you go, I've got no saliva in my face.
It's like, oh, what happened to the air in here? Oh gosh, don't. I went to an open mic once, and I was trying this brand new 6 minutes of material, and the guy before me did this horrible, horrible set. It was like, I don't want to go into it, it was pretty graphic, but it was very like kind of horrible, kind of like taboo. The audience hated it, essentially. It was a very kind of disgusting set. And so I followed this lovely gentleman, and I have never experienced a room of like very uncomfortable people not making a single sound for 6 minutes.
Oh yeah.
And it was that same aspect of like, oh gosh,
yeah,
like come on, anybody, yeah, give me eyes, I need someone sympathetic eyes right now. And you're just like, you're like, oh goodness, and you just leave the stage, you're like
like, I'll take a grimace, a grimace, and I'll convince myself that it was a part smile.
I'll take you like miming with your hand like a face at this point in time.
I'll be wrapped.
So I feel you to that, like, yeah, it's just that level of like, oh my god. And when you know you're about to walk into that, that feeling of like, well.
And there's a brief moment where, and this is the thing that keeps you coming back, there's this brief moment where you think, you know, maybe I can do this.
Yeah.
And then, like, 30 seconds later, you go, why did I think that? Yeah. Like, why didn't I just set myself on fire and shoot myself into the sun? It would have been preferable to this experience.
But that's kind of why I love comedy. Like, I think of it as, like, some, like, hybrid of, like, funny social Sudoku. Like, there's an element where it's strategic. And if you, like, look at the numbers correctly, you can align the right number in the right box.
Yeah.
And there's a technicality to it. And then at some point, that whole premise and the number system you've been working with actually doesn't translate. It's the wrong numeric system you've been working with the entire time. So you were technically correct and on point. But the audience for this night were like, meh.
Yeah.
The audience the next night crying at you, like saying the word trousers.
Oh, yeah.
And it's that, yeah, it's the fun element of like, what am I going to get? I've planned. I've put my strategies in place. Now let's see how they go.
You can't be angry for choosing a career that's not boring when it's not the same every time.
Yeah.
You have to go, this is why I do this.
Yeah.
So you also just mentioned two things that I want to come back to that I have equal interests in. One I have only, like I have interest from afar, but one is something that I used to be right into, and that is Dungeons & Dragons, I'm curious to know where you first discovered D&D, because for me it was as a kid when E.T. came out and they were playing D&D.
Yes.
And then I went into the, I think Angus and Robertson, and I saw the original first edition bought it, and my friends and I used to play it. I wish I'd, you know, because I was a kid, you know, we cut up all the pages and everything. You look back at that, probably would have been worth a bit now, but I was a big fan of D&D and had so much fun playing it, and I've really enjoyed, like, I haven't played it in like decades, but I really enjoyed that it's around again. It's like one of those things, like when you said D&D, I was like, oh, D&D. So how did you get the interest? Because, hang on, how old are you?
I'm 28.
Right, so I'm 48. So there's a big gap here. So I'm curious to know, what was your introduction to that?
I don't think I had a... It's kind of like when people ask me, like, do you remember when you found out Santa wasn't real? Like, I never remember when. Yeah. I kind of always knew, I think, at some point. Or at some point, it was made aware to me, and I was like, all right. And I just kind of sailed on, like... And the same with D&D. Like, I never had this kind of formal introduction. I think it was always part of pop culture. Like, any American high school film ever was like, look at the nerds playing D&D. I'm a jock, and I throw a football. And... that's all the 90s high school films from America. And so it's always played in my mind, but I've always been a big fan of video games and gaming and board games in general. And a lot of that kind of lore that comes from D&D inspires so much of that. Like, you know, board games, whether based on castles or anything with an orc in it or an elf, or they all have these roots back into, like, D&D. And obviously... actually, I wonder... I've never found out. Lord of the Rings came first, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
And they all kind of, like, have this origin, like, kind of like the evolutionary tree. If you string all these animals that look different, like, at some point, they come from the same origin source. But it was during that Mardi Gras show when someone said, would you like to be a part of it? And I was like, oh, I've never actually been able to play the game.
Yeah.
I've heard of the game. I love the game. But because it requires someone with a lot of knowledge about the game... and a group of people with the time commitment regularly to play it.
Yeah.
A lot of those factors don't align easily unless you're an adult or unless you are a kid with very good organized friends.
Right, right.
Which I was not privy to either of those friends or organized ones at that. And so, oh gosh, that sounded drab. I was fine. So we played in this live show. First time I ever played D&D. I had no clue what I was doing. I played this old elven woman, and she was kind of Jehovah Witness-esque.
Right.
She would, like, instead of, like, using, like, spells, I think she was a bard, and she would just, like, attack people by using prose of this faux Bible that she had. And I remember, like, random snippets. I'd just get a book, and I'd be like, I'll pick out a word. And I'd be like, and then Jesus said, why are you in the parking spot that I clearly indicated to go in? And I would just go off on this tangent, and people enjoyed it.
Great.
And then afterwards, when I was like, with the people involved, I was like, oh, I actually really want to continue doing this. I enjoy the game, and people like it, and we like it. Let's just do it.
Keep doing it.
And still to this day, we play it, we have it as a podcast, and we do live shows occasionally. And, I'm still the ignorant player. I'm still the player who's like, that spell that I do all the time that I've been doing for the last 3 years consistently. What's the dice on that one again?
Right.
and then everybody else around me knows everything like that. It's like a level 3 spell and you need 2d6s and 1d10 and roll it twice. And all of that into it. And you can use this because you're wearing this armor. And I'm like, thank you.
Yes. And I will now do that.
I know I do. But it was only up until that point. But... ever, like, before then, I've always wanted to play, but just the alignment of all of the requirements needed for that were never right.
Yeah.
But it's a beautiful game.
It's fun. And I was lucky. I had a friend who was a couple of years older than me. He was also into, I can't remember quite what these were called, if I can look it up without being too distracting. I think they were like choose your own adventure books, but were they fighting fantasy?
I can't remember, but I know what you mean. I think my partner was playing one recently, actually.
Oh, really?
He delved back in online.
Is it Steve Jackson? Is the American game designer Steve Jackson? Let's just get it right up there. It is like Scorpion Swamp.
Yeah.
Was one of the games. What's it called? People are listening to this going, mate, it's blah, blah, blah. And I was like, yeah, I know.
Just screaming at us.
That's what I'm trying to look up, mate. Why are you stressing me?
We'll get there.
God, why is it not just telling me? It's just saying book by. No, sorry, I've just become.
That's all
fighting
good.
Fan. It was fighting Fight fantasy. Fan. There we go. It was.
You Steve had it Jackson. The whole time.
I had it the whole time. So my friend was into that as well, and he used to take like a Island of the Lizard Men and turn that into our own D&D campaign. And he was also a big heavy metal head. Like what you know. The classic cliche, the heavy metal nerd who's across everything. So then he was bringing in characters that were, you know, inspired by albums by Anthrax and Slayer, you know. So it was all heaps of fun and just creative, you know, just so creative. And, yeah, no idea is a bad idea. I probably spent more money on graph paper than I did on anything, and you'd have fun creating your
it's
places.
Beautiful for that. And because not only as the person also known as Dungeon Master or DM, if you're not privy to Dungeons & Dragons, but also the players get to experiment with different chains of their own being. Like you can be anyone you want to be, whether that's very true to yourself or this very like ambitious character that you wish you were. You can make decisions that were like, what if I do that? I'm just going to see what happens. And I think it allows for that sometimes critical thinking development, sometimes imagination, sometimes creativity that I think a lot of the school curriculums actually lack. So I think it's a great game, especially for kids to play.
Yeah.
Because you're just questioning things and it doesn't feel like learning, but you're like, what if I did this?
Right.
How would this play out? What if I do that? What if I said this?
Yeah.
And it's a safe kind of imaginative world to do that in.
Yeah, and a good DM as well knows how to kind of give a little nudge here or a little nudge there, or just let something play out. And you know, it's crazy to think that you would sit around a table essentially with, you know, 20-sided dice and maybe, you know, some things written down, and you'd have a map on some graph paper, and you would genuinely get excited when, fuck, we're dealing with a dragon, or, you know, a beholder has turned up. Or I remember my mate and I playing until like 4 a.m, which as kids is late, and it was you know, the Dracula one, Ravencroft, I think. So, and getting like, we freaked out while we were playing it, and it's just pure imagination.
It's so fun. We did a Christmas show at GD, Giant Dwarf in Sydney, and we had Jordan Roscopolis. She came and played with us, and the character like our DM had set up was this evil toy maker, and he had like taken over the town and like was using these toys to attack people, kind of in a, like a small soldiers-esque way. One little toy was this, and he was also like very old-fashioned, so all these toys were very like the Barbie does the girl jobs and the male, you know, the Kens do the man jobs.
Yeah.
And one of them was that we'd like riffed on the spot was this little office assistant who was in their kind of little plastic container that dolls are in that came with its own glass ceiling. And then
so funny.
And then we had to help this little doll overcome that.
Yeah.
And there's this beautiful moment where like Jordan's character was like, here, let me help you, and smashes the little fake glass ceiling in the packet so she can be a manager. And then our DM is like, oh, it would have been, you know, more better for me to do it myself, but gee, thanks. It's just like, because I think a lot of people think Dungeons & Dragons is going to be orcs, medieval, old, you know, timey-wimey stuff. But it's like, oh no, you can have very contemporary, very weird stuff, very political stuff, very, you know, you can have tanks and modern warfare. I know there's a podcast called Dungeons & Daddies, which is not the gay daddies. it's PG, but they're just fathers that just go around being dads in this universe. And like,
that's funny.
Dungeons and puppies, where they're all like like running around like little dogs in the city doing and so it just allows all of this like random creativity as well.
And it's and it kind of gets back to a little bit like when you were really young and you would just play with the stuff that you had, and there weren't rules. So if you know, like if your He-Man action figure is meeting a Transformer, that just happened.
Yeah.
Like, and that adventure was that adventure. Yep. It wasn't like, well, they can't meet. Like, they're completely different universes.
Exactly.
You know? And the other thing was you're fascinated with Egyptology.
Mm.
And Egypt has always been a place that I've always been fascinated with. I've always been really keen to go and see the pyramids. There is something, like, I'm not religious, but there's so much mysticism with it. Mysticism's not quite the right word, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You can feel it when you look at it and you know, wow, there is a lot of history here. There's a lot of stuff going on. And I'd love to know what piqued your interest.
I think I've always... I find a similar thing. Like, I find the history of ancient Egypt to be like that kind of like person you're attracted to in a bar wherever you are, and they're kind of mysterious and like they're giving answers in a cool kind of suave way, but like you're like, I don't know what's going on with you, but I'm intrigued anyway. Like, you haven't really given me an answer, but I'm still here for it. And it's the same with like the entire pretty much history, because there's a lot that they do know but 10 times more that they don't. And so even when you are reading things about that you're interested in, they're like, we still don't know if it was this, that, that, or that, but here's a rough story. So you kind of get the same thing. You get a little bit to be like, this has sparked my curiosity, but not enough to be like, and in 1949 when this person went into this build, like, you know, you kind of contemporary history and you're like, well, they did that and then they did that and then they did that and they did that, and there's 20 sources and here's video footage, and which I find quite appealing. And again, being into board games and that kind of realm, it comes up a lot as well. It feeds into this kind of like you either go the orcs and elves, or you go with like Roman history or Greek or ancient Egyptian or Norse kind
It was funny. As a kid, it was probably Greek mythology and Norse mythology through Thor comics. This is a mythology, and then you know you read the comic, and Thor's a handsome blonde haired guy, and then you read the mythology, and he's a big ginger.
Yep.
You know, it's like, wow, all right, I see what's going on here. And then the fascinating thing about the Egypt stuff, the Egyptian mythology is so strange compared to, like, you know, after you've gone from Greek and Norse, where they look like you and me, and then suddenly they have the head of a jackal, and the way it's sort of seemed to be intertwined with the rising and the falling of the River Nile, and then just these fascinating things where, remember the I forget which, this might be all the pyramids or it might just be the Great Pyramid, they had the sections that went from the surface all the way in. They thought they were the places so they could breathe, and then they worked out where the stars were, and they were pointing at Beetlejuice.
Yeah.
And it's like, whoa, that is... What the fuck is going
on
here?
It's so fascinating. Yeah, I think one of the early references that we have that people found out that the world was actually curved, or round rather, not flat. Apologies if you believe the world is flat. I doubt you're listening to the podcast. But one of the... It's not necessarily Galileo, but one kind of like researcher, scientist equivalent in ancient Egypt had set up two obelisks in two different cities, kind of like one up in the top of Egypt and one at the bottom, and noticed the shadows that were different at different times and the curve. And they were like, okay, they, you know, did some rudimentary figurines to be like, okay, well, this shows it can't be exactly straight. And so there's an element of like that insight into scientific development here as well, which I find fascinating. I think that one of the most fascinating parts of Egyptology to me is that they run, at least what we know of them as a people and a population, is that they run very differently to how our society is set up now. We are a fact-based society, and even religions, which people would argue, oh, they're not fact, I've never seen blah, 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 you can't prove they exist or not. It's based on things did happen or they didn't happen. You can't have this story and that story if they compete in timelines or they compete in values and stuff like that. But the Egyptians would believe every story at once. So the earth was created in way A, but also in way B, and they are in contradiction to each other. But that's okay because they both happened. Where we as the people would be like, well, no, you have to pick one. I either believe the god Amun or I believe god Isis in this version, in this cult of Isis or that cult of Isis. But they were happy to believe multiple stories of origin, stories of trial, stories of combat, stories of the afterlife as the same thing.
That's fascinating. Especially, we live in such binary times. You're this or you're that.
Yep.
What do you mean you're in the middle?
Yeah,
pick a side. Like, people love to say that. Pick a side.
Pick a side.
Don't make a choice. But then it's, this, I like both of them. So, you know.
But it is also weird because it's not even necessarily like a choice to them. It's not you're sitting on the fence. Yeah. It's like, they're yes and yes.
Yes.
I'm not in contradiction with myself.
Right.
It is.
Yeah.
And when the majority is like that, it's very a perplexing idea to understand how people navigated a very complicated religious system based on that. Because you're like, how do people all conscribe to the same idea if the ideas are ever shifting?
Right.
And you go from one town and they worship a particular god in... and then you go to the same town like a few years later and the story might have changed a little bit. Or another story. Or two more. Or none at all.
Right. That's fascinating. And what were you reading recently? Because when we were having a bit of an exchange, you said there was something interesting that you were reading at the moment.
Well, it was actually on the topic of religion. So it's I struggle to say this word. Polytheist, a multi-god religion.
Yeah.
Many people probably know at least a few of them. You've got Isis, you've got Ra, you've got Set, Bastar, if you're a bit more well-read. And I was reading about a pharaoh called Akhenaten, and he is probably one of the most forgotten but important pharaohs in kind of the Egyptian timeline, in terms of he kind of broke tradition and decided to try and convert everybody into one single monotheistic religion, to pray to the sun, essentially, called Aten. So at that time there was many different gods, and there were stories about how the sun rotated through the sky. You might have heard that Ra and goes along the river every day and night and has to battle this serpent in order to survive, and if he survives then the sun comes up the next day, and all of these beautiful, beautiful stories. And so he kind of broke tradition and was like, no, I've never seen these things before. I've never seen Ra, I've never seen Set, but I do see the sun. I see the sun every day. The sun is real. This god is real. We should be worshipping this god. And so he kind of upended the entire Egyptian civilization at that point in time for many years, who were conscribed to the same religion, and was set up an entire new capital, kind of banished and outlawed, changed his own name, which in Egyptian kind of culture is very kind of taboo. They believe that words have a magic within them. It's called Maat. And so your name is a promise. A lot of names for women would be good mother, because it's a spell you're giving upon your child, so she grows up and becomes a good mother.
Right.
And so he changed his name to beneficial to Aten. I always forget that one, which basically means he declared himself the most important person to this new god, the sun, and pretty much tried to dismantle this entire thousands of years of history and religion, which obviously didn't go out particularly well.
Right. That's audacious, isn't it? Like,
scandalous.
You know when people say, if you had a time machine, what would you go back to? And people often pick, the big things.
Oh, yeah.
But wouldn't you love to just go back and be there when he just gets up one morning and says, hey, I've had an idea. You go, holy shit.
I've got a little thing I want to try out.
Right.
But he is surrounded by some of the most famous pharaohs that we know. So his wife was Nefertiti.
Oh, right.
She's got a fascinating history where at one point he was kind of scratched out from the records after he died for obvious reasons. They kind of reverted back to their old religion beforehand and kind of wanted to cover up everything that had happened previously. But at one point in time, all records about Nefertiti just stopped. There was no talk of her. She wasn't mentioned anywhere. And so there's kind of competing theories about what happened. Some kind of belief that she was killed because she decided actually Aten's not the way. And her husband was like, well, I can't be with you. You are wrong. You're a heathen. And had her executed. Some people believe that she kind of usurped him.
Right.
There's a pharaoh that came after called Smenkhare, who is kind of referred to with both genders, and there's not much referred to them, and they're not really talked about a lot. And it's very odd for a pharaoh in that time not to have a lot of mention and to be referred by both genders. So they kind of have this theory that she took on this male embodiment and became a pharaoh in her own right and changed the way. And so there's many different theories about her own history. And then his son, actually one more, is that she couldn't produce a male heir in King Henry VIII style.
Right.
And so he offed her and took another mistress and had a son who probably arguably one of the most famous pharaohs of all time, Tutankhamun.
Yep.
Born as Tutankhaten, which essentially means the embodiment of Aten.
Right.
And then, even though he was a 12-year-old child by the time he died, actually had a very political purpose in Egypt's history, because he reverted, at age 10 and 11, when he took the throne, reverted everything his father had done. He changed his name to Tutankhamun, which means the living embodiment of the god Amun. So he's taken on this old religion again, and he said, I am the son of Amun. And he moved the capital back and he set everything back up again. And this is a 9-year-old boy.
Right.
And I think a lot of people know Tutankhamun as the very wealthy. He died and he was a little boy and he had a lot of illnesses, but he was very, was found with a lot of wealth and treasure. And that's kind of why we know him contemporary. But as a political figure, for a 10-year-old boy to be reverting the culture of a growing, prosperous nation from this kind of heathenistic overlord.
That is fascinating. I knew that he was young, but I did not know that he was that young. I thought it was 17 or something like that. I knew it was actually under 18, but I thought it was 16, 17.
I can't remember the age he died. It might be a bit older, but he was very young to be having those types of political influences very early on, to know that to go against your own father. They actually moved one significant factor. He moved his body off his father, which obviously mummification, a lot of people know, it's very sacred process. And so to move the tomb of your father from where he buried in his temple to Aten all the way back to the Valley of the Kings, I believe is where he's buried, was a very drastic and political move.
Right.
Of your own family as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, we can kind of understand that maybe as a political motive, but if you kind of look at a familial lens on that, and it's like, oh, your father's own belief system, and you've kind of desecrated that. So it's a very, very loaded, politically charged history that this young pharaoh had before he died. But we mostly know him through Howard Carter and the wealth and the riches that were left in his tomb, which I find fascinating.
Right. He did that at 10, and we have people who can't cope with Greta Thunberg saying, the environment's freaking me out.
Exactly. And he was a very ill child. Yeah. He's a lot of the scans after him showed he probably couldn't walk. And he had a lot of trauma in his bones because they were quite inbred.
Yeah.
Pharaohs, I think one of Akhenaten's own children was his daughter's child. So he had a child, then used the daughter as a mistress. And, that was pretty fairly common back in those times to keep it within the family. So obviously all these diseases and stuff started to build up.
Yeah. Wow, that is fascinating. That's always so exciting when you kind of know. This is what I mean.
Yeah.
I kind of know bits and pieces and a general gist, and then you hear that and you're like, far out. Where were you reading that? Is there somewhere that people could find this history that's fairly accessible?
I find YouTube is great. So,
YouTube, I've heard of it.
It was set up by the ancient Egyptians.
Right.
Tutankhamun actually did that as well.
It was a busy couple of years.
Yeah, it was very busy. Because a lot of the documentaries are quite old about ancient Egypt.
Yeah.
A lot of them on YouTube, extended videos, and some of them are a little bit outdated. They found new things or they disagreed about certain theories, and just like any kind of field in history. But for the most part, I think they're a great source just to sit back and watch and learn about this kind of culture and how people interacted with the world, because it is so different to how we function now. And I still, even with that knowledge, I still can't imagine how people just navigated life like that.
Yeah.
How people navigated the system of multiple belief systems that are all true but incorrect at the same time, or living in a very hostile place.
Yeah.
Like, they had the Nile, and so along the Nile was quite lush, but creating these grand structures that, like, was hauling these giant stones that were only found in certain parts of northern Africa all the way along the Nile, and doing that in the baking sun in the middle of a summer, you know, like, all of these things, you're just like, how on earth did the civilization grow so big in a place as hostile like that, with a mindset that's so different to what we understand a functioning society, quote unquote, to be now?
Yeah, when you read this stuff, or you listen to podcasts about this stuff, it often I have these moments where I'm like, and there I was a little bit tired because I sat outside with my friends during a summer under an umbrella and got a bit flaked out having a couple of drinks.
Yep.
I need to harden up.
Exactly. I'm like, I'm a little bit warm. Can we turn the aircon on? I'm sitting in the pub with a beer, like, oh, it's a bit warm.
This is too much. Too much. Well, that was great. And I'd love to have you come back on to the podcast and talk about some more stuff. And especially bring back some more stories about Egypt as well.
There's
and the
so
stuff
many.
That you learn.
There's so many great characters that kind of, because it's such a long history, I think people forget we merge it into this kind of like one package of either Cleopatra or Tutankhamun or maybe Nefertiti, but it's thousands of years old, and so there's different variances along the way, and I actually studied hieroglyphs for a year. That's what got me into so I learned to read and write hieroglyphs for a year.
So you must be wrapped with the emoji explosion. So I'm across this.
Yeah, I know this. I got this down.
Yeah.
And then there's all fascinating stuff within the language as well, just the written language and the use of images and the contradictions within itself. You know, you can read it left, right, up, down, backwards.
Right.
It's just the more you go into it, the more unravels, and the more you realize, oh, goodness, there's so much you can get into.
Yeah, I know. It's like if you're going to go down a rabbit hole, go down a rabbit hole of something interesting, people. Don't just be, you know, looking at whatever it is.
I'm biased. Maybe someone's out there like, Greeks are better. and look, I'm not going to say they're better or worse, but they're a good read nonetheless.
They're all fascinating. Where can people find you on social media, or do you have a website?
Yeah, so I'm on social media under AJ Lamarck. I don't do as much Egypt content.
Right.
Actually, I thought of ages ago, I've yet to write the show, but I wanted to create a show called Queen of Denial.
Great.
Obviously, pun intended. And I was like, well, now I've just got to write the show. I've got the name.
You know, that's usually half the battle.
So hopefully there'll be a lot of Egyptian content in there. But AJ Lamarck on social media.
Okay, that's great. thanks for coming on. That was fantastic.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you to AJ Lamar and Garth Jones for helping me make this episode of Big Squid for you. Remember, you can find AJ on the socials and Garth over at passtheamel.com. I'm looking forward to having them back on the podcast soon. Hopefully soon. God, it's so hard to tee things up and get schedules in line, but there's stuff that we want to talk about, and as I said, more work with these people in the future. If you're enjoying this season, please leave us a great review at Apple Podcasts, or more importantly, suggest us to anyone who you think would enjoy our work. Word of mouth is actually the best way to go with these types of shows, and I know that the podcast world is flooded. I remember my old podcast, Can You Take This Photo, Please? You know, you had to explain to people what a podcast was when I was first doing that. I wasn't the first by any stretch of the means. I was introduced to it by some youngsters in Melbourne back in the day, and, you know, the normal routes. But, way back in the previous decade, you had to explain what a podcast was. I know there's, you know, so many out there now, and it's hard to, you know, break people's routines and patterns. But if you would like to suggest it to those that you think would enjoy this, as I said, word of mouth is the best way to go. No stress. Don't feel like you have to. It would just be appreciated. I'll be back later in the week with our next episode in the Leftovers Rewatch. That's a fun episode as well. I've really enjoyed those. I'm trying to write slightly different podcast for The Leftovers. It's not just because it's me by myself, but I'm trying to add a little bit more poetry to the podcast. Not poetry. I can't really think. Never go off on a tangent when you're not quite certain what you want to say. But anyway, I'm just trying to make them feel a little bit fuller. And I'm trying to give you the feel that I felt when I would read Alan Sepinwall's reviews back in the day, when I would watch an episode and not have anyone to talk to. And then I'd read Alan Sepinwall's recaps and I'd think, oh, this guy gets it. So I'm trying to give you that sense and make it a little bit more personal and a little bit quieter and a little bit more one-on-one. Anyway, that's coming up later in the week. Next week, we welcome Ben Elwood back to the podcast to continue our Sofia Coppola series with Marie Antoinette. So that gives you a little bit of time to watch that movie if you want to get that in before you listen to the podcast. And don't forget, author Ryan Hughes, the author of XX, A Novel Graphic, is coming up soon. So if you want to rip into his novel about the world's first contact with alien life, and you know what, to be honest, that description is both correct and doesn't do the novel justice. It's so inventive and it's so fascinating and it's mesmerizing, and it really gave me that feeling at the end of 2001. You know, the end of 2001, the first time you watch it, you just go, what the fuck is happening? My mind is expanding. That's what the book did. Anyway, that's coming up in a couple of weeks, so gives you enough time to get a head start on the novel if you want to get ahead of it a little bit. Ah, man, I can't tell you how wrapped I am with the time he gave me. And also, just what a great, fascinating guy. Just, it's so much fun to talk to people who are incredibly creative. And there's more interesting ideas in that one podcast than you'll hear in most podcasts for a year. I know. Let's jump on the hyperbole train, people. I'm taking off. Okay, I'm rambling. Let's finish with a quote from Quentin Tarantino, the man who coined the term Ozploitation, and what he thinks of these Australian movies. Tarantino said, "Australian genre films were a lot of fun because they were legitimate genre movies. They were real genre films and they dealt in a way like the Italians did with the excess of genre. And that has been an influence on me." Until then.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.